So, hello and welcome to today's panel discussion, Canadian Perspectives on Critical Minerals and Security, brought to you by the NATO Association of Canada and Arctic 360. My name is Kate Todd, and today I'm joined by Dr. Jessica Shadian, President and CEO of Arctic 360, and our three amazing panelists: Andrew Gaddis, Director of the Critical Mineral Task Force at Natural Resources Canada; Dr. Heather Exner-Perot, Director of Energy, Natural Resources, and Environment Program at the Macdonald Laurier Institute and Fellow at the Wilson Center and Arctic 360; and Chris Hodgson, President of the Ontario Mining Association and former Provincial Member of Parliament in Ontario, having served in several positions including Minister of Northern Development and Mines, Minister of Natural Resources, and Chairman of the Management Board. So thank you all for joining me today.
My pleasure.
Thanks. And to start, Jessica has a few words, so over to you.
Great, and thank you, Kate. I really appreciate collaborating with you on this event. Obviously, there's a huge intersection between critical minerals and national security and defense related issues. And this is, you know, particular, I think, even to the North, maybe we should say especially. So, Kate, as you mentioned, I'm the president and CEO of Arctic 360. We're Canada's premier Arctic think tank. We're a nonpartisan, registered, not-for-profit organization with a majority Indigenous-led Indigenous leadership team. And our mission is to elevate the national conversation about Canada's North and the Arctic region, and to really provide an inclusive and coordinated platform for Canada to engage in Arctic discussions around the world. And so towards that aim, we work with Indigenous corporations, northern governments, the federal government, the private sector, Arctic leaders, like-minded neighbors, think tanks, and institutions around the circumpolar North and beyond. And this past February, we held our annual conference, which brings together all of those mentioned players, and it's to advance the conversation and foster action that can help build a sustainable, peaceful and prosperous Arctic region. And so among other topics, we held a session on Canada's northern critical minerals potential, and that included a discussion on everything from building supply chains to Indigenous equity and the infrastructure required to really realize that potential. And we were very fortunate to have a keynote by Andrew Gaddis, who provided an overview of Canada's critical mineral strategy. And we also had Heather Exner-Perot, she moderated a conversation on innovation out of the Arctic, and of course, critical minerals is not far, and it's really part of that conversation. And so I hope that this conversation today can build on some of what was discussed and learned at our February conference. And I'll just lastly say that the videos for all of our sessions will be up on our Arctic 360 website by the end of the week. And again, Kate, I really want to thank you and the NATO Association for, you know, having the opportunity to collaborate with you on this, what I think, really important discussion. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jessica. It's really a pleasure on our end as well and on my end personally. So thank you for that, and thank you for the introduction. So now we'll jump right into our questions and have a little bit of a preamble. So last year, Canada put out a critical mineral strategy. And since then, in the news, we've been hearing about major investments the government and businesses are making in our critical mineral supply chains, like the recent announcement about the VW battery plant. So, Andrew, in Canada's critical mineral strategy and the media, critical minerals are often called strategic assets and are talked about in terms of their importance in the green energy transition. Can you explain how they're important to Canada's security and economy too?
Sure. Thanks, Kate. That's a great question. Obviously, I think critical minerals are a bit at this intersection of some the geopolitical side of things, the environmental and also the economic. You have a bit of this overall transition occurring within the market space as countries and their economies and firms move to cleaner and greener technologies. And ultimately, the driver behind that is in the need in that space is critical minerals. And that's important not just for the things like electric vehicles, but that's also important for other technologies like the defense industry as well. And also some of those dual use technologies, whether we're talking about semiconductors. And so the space is quite has quite evolved a bit. And I think we're starting to see more interconnection points between critical minerals and a number of key technologies that are important both for economic security, but also for our climate change ambitions.
Okay, thank you. And Heather, I just was wondering if I could get your take on that. So how critical minerals are important to Canada economically as well as security-wise. Oh, you're muted.
My bad, after 3 years of COVID, still muting myself. So obviously minerals and the mineral sector is a huge portion of the Canadian economy. I think it was last year a record, $56 billion worth of mineral production. Critical minerals are a smaller portion of that. So by far the biggest minerals that we produce and sell are coal, gold, potash. Those are not considered critical minerals. Then it starts to get into, you know, copper and nickel, and those are critical minerals. But the lion's share are not critical minerals. I think that's important to understand, because the money going into exploration and investment is often not going into critical minerals either. But in terms of security of supply, so, you know, Andrew kind of mentioned, you know, all, okay, so it's important for security, it's important for the economy, and it's important for our climate goals. And it is all those things. And so it's a matter of that security of supply. And I think one thing people don't always appreciate, the extent to which critical minerals are geographically concentrated. And we're all very well aware of oil wars and the role of oil in geopolitics in the last 50 years. And oil is everywhere. Oil is everywhere. Gas is everywhere. Refining capacity is everywhere. Every region has significant supplies. So it is. So, and we still had wars over it. And critical minerals, you know, are very concentrated, sometimes in three or four countries, you are making up 70, 80, 90% of a particular mineral. So it is a huge security concern going forward. The more and more that we have our energy systems rely on critical minerals and on renewables and on the green transition, there will be security aspects popping up for sure.
And speaking of those regional differences, would you be able to speak to where in Canada there are critical mineral deposits?
Sure. I'm from Saskatchewan originally, so I love to talk about potash and uranium, and we're huge globally significant producers in those. I pulled it up because we all know about nickel and copper and manganese, but the hard ones produced, niobium, palladium, we're also very significant global producers of those critical minerals. And even though they're small quantities and maybe small production numbers and value, they're still critical to a lot of the things we do. I think the two biggest deposits that people are eyeing up is obviously Ring of Fire, which is, you know, taking forever, and there are no mines, and everyone's, you know, doing their best to try to get that producing. And then in BC, the Golden Triangle. I think those are the two areas that maybe people are most excited, but Canada's the second biggest country. We got the second most geology, you know, just by virtue of that. So there's we have all the 31 critical minerals that NRCan designates.
So speaking of the Ring of Fire, that sort of segues into a second question I wanted to pivot towards. So, Chris, much of the conversation around critical minerals centers on how Canada can be a responsible first choice supplier for minerals for our allies. So do you think Canada, given your experience, Ontario as well, is doing a good job balancing the need for critical mineral exploration and concerns around how mining impacts the environment and Indigenous rights, particularly around the Ring of Fire region where there are multiple Indigenous First Nations that are impacted?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. The I should first just clarify, I represent the operating miners in Ontario. So it's the large companies, there's about 37 active mining operations. And of our members, we have about 142 active agreements with our First Nation partners. So we've got a good mature relationship there, and we feel that that's going to continue in the future. There is a challenge at the exploration stage, and I don't represent the grassroots explorationists because you're dealing with flow through shares and not real money, and sometimes you don't have capacity on either sides to do what's required under the constitutional authorities that have been delegated for the constitution of the provinces and to the industry proponents. We've got massive production of minerals in Ontario. We have over 20% of Canada's total output. And of those 37 mines, about 10 of them produce what you refer to as critical minerals. Of the 31 critical minerals identified by NRCan, the Ontario government also put out a critical minerals strategy that we helped develop. Our smelters produce about 14 of those critical minerals as a byproduct of nickel, copper production, and we have a large production of the platinum groups, the PG and they're essential. These minerals used to be called rare earth. It was misnamed. They're not rare. They're just China has large, easily economical deposits, and Ontario, Quebec, and Greenland have sort of untapped potential. We have small deposits that have been identified, and up until now, they haven't really been economical. They are now, because the world's recognized that the supply lines are vulnerable. They probably should have recognized that 10 years ago when China did the same thing to Japan when it came to trying to rebalance their trade. They were threatened to withhold critical minerals, or at that time rare earth, and Japan realized they couldn't manufacture anything, so they capitulated. The U.S. has been trying to renegotiate their trade agreements for, you know, at least 6 or 7 years. They threatened to buy Greenland in order to bring China to the table. It seemed to work for a short period of time. Now that's off the table, but I believe Bill Gates and others are buying it because of its potential for rare earth. So it'll be privatized instead of a national sort of strategic initiative. But Ontario's got a tremendous advantage, not only in terms of our safety record, which has had a 96% improvement in the last 30 years in terms of lost time injury. So we're one of the safest mining jurisdictions, but we also have an almost carbon-free grid. So the nickel produced out of Ontario has the least carbon of any nickel produced in the world. And the same with the copper that comes out of Ontario. So that's really, you know, not only is copper and nickel essential to the electrification of the global economy, but it's produced in a green fashion in Ontario compared to other jurisdictions. So we think we've got huge advantages here. We just need to tap it. And as was mentioned by Andrew, you know, there is an intersection of geopolitical challenges along with environmental challenges and opportunities that we think we can play a crucial role making the world a better place to live.
Okay, fantastic. Well, thank you. And Heather, so a lot of your work has focused on Indigenous policies as well as Northern economic development. So I was wondering if you had any thoughts on this as well.
I do. First, I'll start with just, you know, rare earths, because this is a very important anecdote. In Northwest Territories, they did have some rare earth mining, the Netchalocha project. And just last week, Cheetah Resources announced that it was not economic, that they were going to pursue it further, and they weren't going to continue their investment in a rare earth processing plant in Saskatoon, that the government of Saskatchewan had also been investing kind of a joint effort there, which just goes to show, yes, we all know we need rare earths, but the prices are still, in most cases, not at a level to be spurring more mining investment. So I hope to get to that part, you know, later on in the conversation. But speaking to the Indigenous and Arctic aspect, you can see I'm in a hotel room at the First Nations Major Projects Coalition Conference now, where this is obviously a big topic of conversation. How can we do Indigenous engagement participation in a way that obtains consent and provides benefits to these communities, but also gets mines up and running in a reasonable amount of time and produces these security and these economic and climate benefits from everyone? And part of the conversation is becoming equity, participation, equity stakes. And that often makes more sense for things like pipelines, transmission lines, LNG terminals, utility kinds of projects rather than mines, because mines tend to be riskier. But there are probably some models that we could be introducing into that to give communities that higher level of participation on top of the regular, very important things like the procurement and the employment and the involvement in the environmental monitoring and that kind of thing. So we are getting much better. I think it still takes a lot of time. I think the regulatory system takes a lot of time to get through this. It's not always clear. Sometimes it's competing between the federal and the provincial processes. Sometimes it's competing between the IAA and navigable waters and fisheries and all those different aspects. So there's certainly room to streamline them, but communities are getting more savvy, are figuring out ways to participate. We have good models for impact and benefit agreements, and there's a lot of good news stories around this country. On the Arctic side, and I'm sure we'll get into it more, but one of the reasons, you know, Canada is not a mining superpower. And when you look at the top countries of mining, maybe the other usual suspects, the other four biggest countries are the top four, China, Russia, United States, and Australia. And you think, well, Canada is one of those huge countries, and we're around number eight, depending on the year. So we are punching below our weight. And one reason for that is just the tremendous lack of infrastructure in the Canadian North, that it makes it more expensive to access and to take out. So when we think about that, if we do have this critical mineral strategy and our allies are coming to us with this need, and we do need these minerals for the transition, then we have to figure out ways to make it more economic and improve the infrastructural space to do this in the north, on top of getting Indigenous consent to do it.
So pulling on that thread that both you and Chris have put down, so China does have much of the control over the world's critical mineral processing facilities, and that was framed in the critical mineral strategy as well as in the media as a danger to Canada and our allies, and justification to work towards creating resilient allied and domestic supply chains. So Andrew, from your end, I was wondering what's being done to advance critical mineral mining and refining in Canada to make it easier for the sector to outcompete and maybe become one of the top five, let's say, in the world, rather than the eighth in developing critical minerals?
Yeah, so I wouldn't say so much a danger. I call it more of a risk. I mean, as Chris noted, I mean, China was... but had the foresight to kind of predict where the economies were going to go over the long term, even in the rare earth space when they bought the technology for rare earth manufacturing, which was originally created by General Motors and a Japanese company and moved to China, and now they dominate that supply chain. So, but there's a risk in that as supply chains have become increasingly concentrated, as the market has looked for the lowest cost input, now we find ourselves in a bit of a more difficult situation as the demand for clean technologies increases. There's this economic opportunity, but then there's this vulnerability associated with relying on a single market for all of your inputs and the manufactured goods that come with it. And so I think recognizing that, the first step for us was the development of the critical minerals list. And the creation of that list, we came at it from a different perspective than, say, the United States or the European Union or Japan. We looked at what could Canada actually produce nationally, not in the long term, but in the near to medium term, and what would be important for our supply chain resiliency and the manufacturing that we wanted to produce here. So I think that was the starting point, because identifying what we had and where we wanted to go was kind of got the ball rolling. The second step was obviously the critical mineral strategy. When you read it, you know, we've really tried to not just focus on the mineral side. That's key. That's fundamental to it. But it's also about building the value chain in Canada with allies to the largest extent possible, recognizing that, you know, not at all manufacturing can exist in Canada. We just don't have enough of people to do everything that we despite our ambition. And that focus really is on what we call the upstream side, so the mineral extraction, but also on the processing. As you noted, China is quite dominant in this space. And so we need to anchor our position within those value chains by having that smelting, refining capacity that already exists. And so that's where we're trying to target some of the investments that we've made through the strategy. So in particular, the Strategic Innovation Fund, $1.5 billion for what is seems like a big number, but this is a capital intensive sector overall, but really targeting those investments on the processing side. The same thing with some of our earlier stage R&D funding, so about $144 million in that, and that's supporting companies refine their processing technologies to be able to get become more efficient, reduce the environmental footprint, and be more proficient in that space, because it acts as an anchor not only for the minerals so that they have a place to send their product within Canada, but then it also provides an opportunity for those downstream suppliers to find the inputs that they need that have already been processed while we're capturing value-added activity in a Canadian context. So that's what kind of the strategy is driving at. I think Heather brought up a good point about infrastructure as well. So we're looking at building the value chains, but we're also looking at the things around the value chain that are fundamental to be making it economically competitive. And that's through the infrastructure investments, through the strategy and our work with the Canadian Infrastructure Bank, so that we can create those linkages between maybe a more rural, remote, northern mine site, make sure that it's is connected to the trade infrastructure that gets it to where it needs to go next in terms of maybe further processing, and that helps it then connect it further to the value chain or the supply chain. That's the next part of the equation. And also doing that in a way that encourages clean energy production where possible, or connecting to the grid through transmission lines or supporting renewables on site to, you know, to offset the use of diesel. And all of these things combined not only make those projects more economically competitive and position us more strongly in terms of that global ranking, but they also give us a bit of a premium because we're developing these deposits and the midstream capacity in the right way. That's more environmentally friendly, that respects the rights of Indigenous peoples. And then through that, we're able to also extract a premium, and that helps differentiate us within the market space as well. And that allows us to kind of grow our projects and our footprint in the space in a bit of a different way as well.
You mentioned a bit about how we are working with partners to advance our critical mineral supply chains. And I was wondering if you could speak about or a bit about Canada's recent cooperation with the U.S. Regarding EVs as well.
Sure. So I think going back a little bit back in time, one of the big catalysts for Canada, I think, on the critical minerals front was the U.S. Wanting to launch the Joint Action Plan on Critical Minerals Collaboration. And that's been subsequently renewed through different U.S. and Canadian administrations. But really, that formed the basis of this partnership in the critical mineral space, and it touches on a number of different areas, whether it's the defense space, just looking at kind of collaboration between our geological surveys, the Canadian, the Australian, actually, and as well as the American, looking at R&D opportunities, the security environment, all of that. And that provided a bit of an initial framing on which we're kind of continuing to build the collaboration. I think obviously Canada and the U.S. have similar ambitions, probably on the economic side. You're seeing battery plants being announced both on both sides of the border. Everyone wants to kind of secure those types of investments. We obviously think we have a bit of an advantage on the Canadian side because we are quite proficient on the mining side and then also on the processing to make those full value chain connections. But we can't do it in isolation. We have to do it together. The demand is too high. And as I noted on the manufacturing side, we can't produce everything in Canada, and then the United States doesn't have all the materials that it needs to get into that space as well. And so I think that's why the collaboration will continue, where the engagement is pretty regular and pretty constant. I think that's only going to continue, and we're obviously working with other partners, whether it's Japan, South Korea, the EU has a bit of a more tight-knit community on terms of how we're developing supply chains within this space and adding to that overall resiliency within those chains, because I think we share the same concerns about risk and over-reliance on certain markets, and we're also trying to capture those same economic opportunities as we kind of embark on this industrial shift to capture the as part of the green energy transition.
So, Chris, from your perspective in Ontario, do you think that Canada's doing enough to make it easier for mining to flourish in the country? Do you think that it is being done fast enough? Because Andrew has mentioned billions of dollars of investments, but it's just also a matter of, I guess, how fast do we need critical minerals, and when will we actually be seeing these supply chains sort of complete? So I was just wondering, on your perspective about if enough is being done.
I think the strategy is right. I think NRCan's done a lot of thinking on this. And I think they've identified the priorities to have a healthy sovereign country. I don't think they spent enough time looking at how you do that in terms of political risk. And I'm talking about the U.S. here. If you take a look at our forest industry, you know, they talk free trade, but they put on quotas knowing that they're not legal. They don't even want it to be heard at a tribunal. But they're starving Canada's capital. So that money that goes in escrow stops the recapitalization of our mills. So they're not as competitive as U.S. mills. So they get the added value jobs. The best place to get a return on investment right now is investing in U.S. sawmills, not Canada. That was political how they did that. It was very sophisticated. The same with our oil and gas industry. The Biden administration, first thing they did was increase the forest quota, but then they also stopped the transmission of our pipelines. moving our energy to foreign markets. So President Biden, on his visit with the Prime Minister, said the quiet part out loud. He said, well, Canada can mine it, but we want the value-added jobs. So it'll be a mercantile economy if Canada's not sophisticated in this. Elon Musk changed the supply and the nature of manufacturing by moving the processing right beside the raw material. And so when the continent's reset up, and so you're not, it's better for the economy. It's also better for the environment because your supply line's closer to home. The U.S. is looking at it in terms of friendly shoring to try to isolate China, but it still requires a massive reorganization of our supply chains and our manufacturing. The U.S. is actually quite stuck on this because they canceled the big copper mines in the Southwest because there's a disturbance on the temporary land use like mining. They don't want to upset their base of environmental fundraising. So they canceled their access to electrification of raw materials. They're hoping that Canada will provide it for them and they get the added value jobs without the disturbance to their land base. We'd be crazy to agree to that. So I think NRCan's identified the strategy, get the processing plants, get the zoning in place for processing critical minerals, get the exploration working. One of the great advantages that Ontario and Canada's had in the past on our, we're actually the best in the world at hard rock underground mining. And it's not just because of our geology. There's two things. One was basically the rule of law. You knew that if you invested in Canada and followed the rules, you could get a return on your investment. And so we attracted the team for investment. We could borrow money cheaper, pay higher wages, so we got the best workforce in the world. So that's the real advantage that we have. We need to go back to a rules-based investment strategy with our First Nations. And the problem is that we didn't involve Indigenous communities in the rulemaking. And so we've left it to the court since we brought home the Constitution. You've got treaty rights, Aboriginal rights, which weren't defined, federal law, then provincial law. If we want to really work together, we should rewrite those rules and define what Aboriginal rights are. And maybe it's got to be like the question of the Quebec independence was tested as a hypothetical at the Supreme Court. But those rules should be jointly agreed to. I think then your permitting and the other things will happen a lot quicker. My experience is when local people benefit from mining, usually the permitting goes a lot quicker. You know, when the environment's looked after, the health and safety of your workers in the environment, the regulators will take a look at that and say, yeah, it's being done the right way. And the local check on that is monitoring and community involvement. So I think those are two things that have to happen. One is we've got to get a rule of law that attracts international money because infrastructure is going to be a challenge and how you pay for that. And the second is how do we preserve our sovereignty and make sure that it benefits Canadians, this resource. The U.S. Are losing markets around the world because they're not offering the infrastructure that goes along with rebuilding the local economies. They just want the raw material to come to the U.S. Economy. And so President Biden, it's unfortunate he said that out loud, but maybe it's a good warning for NRCan to say, hey, we got the right strategy. We've got to be cognizant of the risk to that strategy.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And Heather, I was wondering what your thoughts would be about how to attract investment or make investment easier in Canada.
So I want to highlight one important fact, and Natural Resources Canada has some really great data. Their annual inventory came out last month, and it shows that since 2019, our critical minerals production is actually declining in Canada. So we know that we need to produce 5-6 times more to meet that's what the IEA says to have the green transition. And this is why, if you look at not just Canadian, but global mining investment, and it mirrors in Canada. We aren't that far off in mining investment. The peak of last boom was 2012. That was the highest year for global mining investment. So we're about 30-35% off that global mining capex peak from 2012. So people say we need 6 times more mining. We're not even at 1 times mining what we were in 2012. We're still living off the bounty of investments that were made a decade ago, let alone increasing production for this green energy transition that everyone wants. So our production of copper is down, cobalt is down, nickel is down, zinc is down, uranium is down, platinum group metals are down, gold is up. and so much of our exploration is actually going into gold because it's a hedge against, you know, inflation and turmoil. So we are very far beyond what we are committing to in 2019, think about critical minerals actually producing. And this should scare everyone, because at the same time as we aren't producing enough metals, critical minerals for the energy transition, we've been tamping down on fossil fuels. So what is going to cover the gap between what we aren't going to be able to cover with oil and gas and what we aren't going to be covered on renewables and uranium on the other side? So how can Canada help? And you don't have to be too critical, because Minister Wilkinson seems to say this every week. It takes 12 to 15 years to build a mine in Canada, and that's too long, and it can't take that long. But he started saying that line, I think, a year or two ago. And 12 to 15, there's no exact average. It depends on the mine and where, greenfield, brownfield, but it takes a long time in Canada, much longer than average. In a situation of high interest rates, every extra year it takes to develop a mine in Canada compared to Latin America or Africa is adding tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars onto the cost. Having to carry the cost for 10 years versus 7 years or 8 years is a huge burden. So it is getting harder to mine in Canada. Actually, it's getting less competitive in Canada. And then I'll finish off with the Arctic, which obviously, you know, a third of Canada's in the Arctic, two thirds is north, obviously potential there. Almost, you know, so much of the mining comes off of diesel mines, because there isn't the infrastructure, there isn't the transmission everywhere, there isn't the gas grid. Diesel is getting extremely expensive because we've cut off kind of oil production. And most big companies don't want to create a new mine that relies on diesel, because that goes against all of their ESG values and goals. And so we are leaving very few opportunities, I think, to attract big money in this country, and far off a rate that we need to contribute meaningfully to the critical minerals needs of ourselves and our allies.
So building off of that, Andrew, I was wondering if you would be able to speak to an update in the Investment Canada Act, where foreign investment was restricted about a year or so ago. I was wondering if you could maybe tell us a bit about that and about how that might impact investments in the critical mineral supply chain here.
I think that some of the changes to the Invest in Canada Act recognize kind of the geopolitical dynamics and also where we find ourselves presently in the mining space. That was really about trying to look at foreign direct investment from state-owned enterprises or state-influenced enterprises, so that we maintained more control and had a better line of sight and scrutiny on those types of investments into the mineral sector, particularly as we're trying to get into these new supply chains. We weren't looking to add to supply chain concentration. We were trying to, you know, diversify. And so that's really the principle behind that. And so we want to make sure that we're growing our natural resource and critical mineral sector in the right way. And so I think that's really what the changes to the ICA policy statement was aimed at. We're trying to draw in investment from alternatives, all other sources as well, recognizing that there is a bit of a some challenges in the market space. So the US has launched the Mineral Security Partnership. This is really aimed at pooling capital amongst like-minded countries to encourage more investment in the critical mineral space, both within Canada and other jurisdictions, so we can increase production. Just on that note, you've also saw in the last budget significant tax credits provided to the mining sector to encourage more mine development. Obviously, that is going to help stimulate more investment because it's offsetting the capital costs associated with entering into that space, which, you know, again, like earn the hundreds of millions of dollars just to get going. And that, in addition to some of the infrastructure incentives that are being provided, and there's also tax credits on the clean energy side as well that mining firms can tap into. So I think there's a bit of a recognition that, you know, we need FDI, we need capital coming in, but we're looking at different ways to stimulate that while also keeping our eye on the prize in terms of looking for as much value added production within Canada wherever possible. I think the EV space is quite clear, but it's not going to be like that for every single mineral. If I take the example, say, of semiconductors, gallium arsenide, we have a huge potential to be a supplier of that. You don't need gigantic quantities of it, but it has to be purified to a really high degree. So you're getting a value added opportunity. If we could also get a semiconductor facility, great. But you know, the markets are moving in another direction. We can at least tap into that value chain, secure some value added production in the Canadian context, while still also supporting greater supply chain resiliency as well. So I just wanted to kind of make those notes, a few of Heather and Chris's points, because I think it's hard to disentangle this. It's all intertwined, the overall approach. I think we need to see more FDI attraction. And what one thing that is actually also happening is you're seeing some of the firms, the OEMs, that I think over the last few decades have not taken as much interest in their supply chains. They've kind of left it to their second tier, third tier suppliers to figure out where the inputs come, to take more active positions on where their minerals coming from and investing directly in down into the upstream component. And so that's actually changing a bit of the market dynamics. There's still a lot to do. We need a ton of more capital flowing into this. The projections are crazy just globally in terms of how much money needs to flow into this to feed this transition. And it doesn't help that we're in a high inflationary period right now, with, you know, credit obviously being tightened up. But we are seeing that that trend, because the supply chain resiliency component for these OEMs is driving their investment decisions and getting them to spend some of the money that they've been sitting on, because for the they've been sitting on for the last while, and reinvesting into new production. So I remain optimistic. The challenge is high, but I think we're starting to see some movement in that space.
Fantastic. Well, for final thoughts, I was thinking I'll go over to you first, Chris. Is there one takeaway that you had from this conversation, or one thing that you think Canada or Ontario should action to incentivize critical mining? Or mining of critical minerals, sorry.
I think I mentioned the two things, you know, the rule of law, to make sure that we can get a more rules-based approach for exploration and for permitting and for EAs. And that involves our Indigenous partners to help them craft the rules with us, test it with the Supreme Court, so people know, you know, when they invest here, they follow the rules, you get a return on that investment. The other thing I'd like to leave you with is that the world has changed. Just take a look at the headlines around tech and Glencore. Then take a look at the BRIC nations. My whole lifetime, you've seen commodities being surplus in the price decline in real dollars, not the just the American currency with, you know, the fiat currencies, but in real purchasing power. That's changed, and the capital that wants to flow into supplying the world of critical minerals is going to be an avalanche. You can take a look at the countries that are pulling away from the U.S. sphere or the West. And what they're saying is they want to be paid for in hard currency for their hard assets. And so whether it's oil, minerals, whatever, and they're going to protect that national endowment. So, you know, I'm a free trader, but I think NRCan's got it right. You've got to have an investment strategy for our resources to make it so we can maintain the best quality of life we can for Canadians. And so that means that we've got to, you know, have the manufacturing added jobs here. For a generation, we've said, no, you don't need to worry about that. We can be financial transactions. In fact, your kids should all just go to higher education, become, you know, accountants, etc. Now, people with skills, when you repatriate, reshore, whatever you want to call it, friendly shoring, you're going to need a lot of the skills that made the country, you know, 50, 60 years ago. There's been two generations since we went through this. So, you know, I think that if you have the right rules in place, we have the favorable geology. We have an educated workforce. The money's going to come. Our challenge is going to be to make sure that we can parlay that into direct benefit for Canadians, or does it flow someplace else?
Fantastic. And Andrew, did you have any final thoughts or words on this?
Yeah, I like Chris bringing up the skills aspect of this, and you know, our ranking may have dropped, but we've been mining for a long time. We have a skilled labor force, and that in this space, and that kind of goes beyond just the core mining into the mining services and the innovation. But we do need more we do need more people going into mining engineering and geology and all of those things that support this, and metallurgy, like the list kind of goes on. And it's not just, you know, mining, it's also other sectors of the economy as well. That you can take the battery value chain and go more downstream. But I think that's a key aspect of it as well, as, you know, because we need, ultimately the capital can flow in, we can have the best intentions and things can make it through the regulatory regime, but if we don't actually have the people to build the projects and run them, we won't be farther ahead. And like Chris noted, it'll move to other areas. So I really like that as a kind of a closing sentiment, to kind of round out all the other aspects of this very intricate topic.
Yeah, and Heather, last but not least.
Okay, I'll start with the optimistic part, but I have to end on some pessimistic notes because there's a lot of headwinds here. On the optimistic part, I mean, Canada's in a tremendous position. What a tremendous position we are, and we will benefit. We are resource-rich, commodities-rich, energy-rich, and the world needs all of that. And as, you know, Chris pointed out, we are coming into a different cycle of the commodity space, and Canada will benefit, and it'll last for a long time. So that's the good news. The bad news is it takes too long to build in Canada. Our permitting and our regulatory system is a mess. I'm sorry, but it is. It needs to be fixed. The Liberals have finally committed in 2023 in the budget to fix it. But there's a lot of doubt in industry that they know how to unwind the things that they've been busy putting into place over the last 7 years. And it'll take time to do the unwinding when it does come. The labor force. The labor force is aging. A lot of Gen Zs don't want to go fly in, fly out and work underground in a mine or work at a camp. It's hard to attract them. We've been telling our youth for 20 years that there's no future in resource extraction, that it's bad to be in resource extraction. We're moving to a knowledge sector and they should get a university degree. And now we have a blue collar shortage. And it's not just mining, it's the transmission, it's the utilities, it's the pipelines, it's everything. That's on the Canadian side. Where it gets really serious from a security perspective, because it's a NATO association thing, you know, is again the total inability, not foreseeable, to see the mines pop up around the world and the numbers we need to have an energy transition, or even to make up the shortfall in the fossil fuels that we are no longer producing. And so energy will get more expensive. When we say that Canada has the opportunity, there is the friendshoring, there is a premium that you can put on having good, clean, you know, wholesome Canadian metals. But if we are selling commodities and processing commodities more expensive than China has been able to or has, first, there is that point where you'll get to demand destruction. There is a point where people cannot afford green energy if it's at Canadian prices, if it's that Canadian processing, that we are not being able to compete on price, and people will burn coal instead. If they can't afford energy at Canadian commodities prices, they will burn coal. And so we all need to get the price of minerals down and bring investment in and do this quicker if we want to have this transition. So there's nowhere you'd rather be than Canada as we go into this new commodities phase. But I think it will be very painful for a couple billion people around the world. And that will create security issues. I promise you that.
Well, on that note, I could keep talking about this all day, but unfortunately, we've run out of time in our discussion. But thank you again to Andrew, Heather, and Chris for your time and for this amazing...
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
If you enjoyed this and want to see more of our programming, check out the NATO Association of Canada's website, natoassociation.ca, and Arctic 360's website, arctic360.ca, and follow us on your favorite social media platform. Thanks for tuning in.